Hello and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 138. On this week's show, we are going to review 1977's Pete Dragon. With me, as always, to my left is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
Joining us via Skype from the Main Street Cassette is Ryan Wilson. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
And also joining us, as always, is Courtney Van Ren. Say hello, Courtney.
Hello, Courtney.
Hello, Pete. And how you doing, folks? Right off the bat, you might notice that there's something a wee bit different about the opening of the show in that we normally have music playing right now. So for those unaware, there was a situation that happened in the last week concerning the music that we normally open the show with Pogo, Nick Bertke. There was a video released, not by him, but there was a video that got released where he says some awful goddamn things, to put it in the most bluntest of terms. It's very homophobic. It's very disgusting. And even though since then I have spoken with Nick a lot, and the idea of the video was supposed to be, it was from about 2 years ago or so, I guess, it was supposed to be a satirical, like Andy Kaufman-esque kind of thing, which fits in line with some other things that he was trying at that time. And even though I believe that, and you know, and all that, there are other issues at hand, I think, overall, that have to be dealt with. And I know that that video was incredibly offensive. It is, even me knowing the context, it's still an awful attempt at whatever they were attempting. Humor shouldn't have boundaries, but satire has to have humor to it, or vice versa. Without it, it's just hate speech. And I think that that's sort of the lesson that's kind of going around right now. So for the foreseeable future, we're not going to use the music, you know, to open the show anymore. If actions, you know, outweigh words going down the line, and I hope they do, because Nick is a friend of mine, and this was a, you know, this was a pretty awful thing to hear a friend of yours say, and I have hope that it was all part of this thing, but his actions have to speak louder than his words. So I think we're all in agreement that for now, we're not going to use any music. We might try to find something to do differently for the opening. I don't play an instrument. I can play an instrument badly. Should we do it on kazoos?
No.
Nope. Melissa says no to the kazoos. Ruining the fun.
Oh, hurt people's eardrums.
No. But so yeah, it's a bad situation. It's an unfortunate situation, but it's much more unfortunate from the people who saw the video and, you know, are involved deeply in that community. It's much worse for them. So out of respect for them, out of respect for everyone who was taken aback from the goings-ons, we're just going to continue with the show the way we normally would, but I just wanted to address it from the beginning. And that's about it. So, going into how I normally go into the rest of the show, we are lastgenpodcast.com. That's L-E-S-T-G-E-N podcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at DizMagicHourPod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. We're on Facebook if you search for Disney Magic Hour. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. And Melissa, Instagram and Patreon, what's the information for that?
On Instagram, we're at Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And if you head over to patreon.com/Disney Magic Hour, you can find ways to help support the show there.
And for our Patreon members, the production assistant level Patreon members, tomorrow, Wednesday, or today when this comes out, we may have actually already done it. This week's thread was, or is, going to be the Black Hole, which I've never seen. So that ought to be fun. I don't know. Ryan, where can everyone find the Main Street Gazette?
At mainstgazette.com. If you're looking for us on Instagram or Twitter, it's mainstgazette. And if you're looking for us on Facebook, just search for Main Street Gazette and you can find the page there.
And Courtney, I know that you and Melissa do the DMH Book Club. What's going on over there? There's a little bit of a sabbatical going on right now, right?
Yeah, we were taking a break through May, but it kind of extended a little bit due to some stuff I've had going on. So we're going to start up again, I think, next week. And we will have a schedule posted for you guys. I know we posted the series, so just find us at DMH Book Club on Facebook, and you can join us for our next series.
All right. Well, We're back to our movies. We're gonna revisit the movie reviews that we normally do this week, and we are gonna take a look at a movie that prior to watching it in the thread with Patreon, I don't know if I ever watched it in full. It is 1977's Peach Dragon. Now, I think Courtney, though, you have a little bit more of a history with this movie than I do.
Yes, sir. One of my very favorites.
When did you watch it as a kid and it's just kind of stuck with you?
I don't remember a time when I hadn't seen this movie. Mm-hmm. It's been that long for me and that early in my life. I ran around my grandma's house singing all the songs and acting things out. So yeah, this is a good one for me.
And Ryan, same with you, right? This movie has a history with your childhood, yes?
It does somewhere. Like Courtney, I can't remember when I first saw it. I just remember I it's always kind of been in my, you know, back in my brain. I can remember the campfire show at Fort Wilderness. If you know the wagon that's on is for Doc Terminus, which we'll get into in this movie. Mm-hmm. And so I remember that being a thing when I was a kid. Like, oh, Doc Terminus, that's from Peach Dragon. Like, I remember that cycle kind of being in my head, but I don't ever remember a time where I hadn't seen the movie.
Melissa, what about you?
No, I've never seen it before we watched it on the thread.
All right, well, let's get into some details about it, and then we're going to pivot over to some other folks for some more information. The movie was released on November 3rd, 1977. The budget was roughly $10 million. Back in those days, we don't really have exact numbers. It grossed about $36 million. Which you would think, like, oh, well, it tripled its budget. It's not bad. Thing was, it was actually viewed as a sort of a large disappointment because they were looking for a Poppins-type hit. You can tell that they were going for that when you watch the movie, but you can also tell they didn't really nail that all that well. It was originally purchased, the rights were. I don't actually... Ryan, did you want to talk about this with the whole rights situation with this film?
Yeah, so it was written by Seton Miller and S.S. Field, and Seton Miller has a storied history with film, going back to A Girl in Every Port, The St. Louis Kid. He did a Charlie Chan movie. Like, he just has he's been around for quite a while. But it was done in the 50s. He had written this story, and Disney acquired the rights to it. At the time, they were going to make it part of the Disneyland television show. It was going to be an anthology series on there. It got shelved. And then it gets back around the 70s. You have Malcolm Morenstein who does some rewriting on it. It was actually like the largest project he had ever been given to do. And maybe we needed to have someone supervise that a little bit better. But
so many songs.
So they revive it in the 70s to bring it back to fruition. And you get to this point where in the production where there was not going to be any – you were never going to see Elliot. You're never going to see the dragon. And then they decide, no, you need to see the dragon, but we're only going to show him at the very end. And then it was like, no, we need to see him a little bit more. And he ends up getting 22 minutes of screen time, which I think is where some of our disjointedness comes up in this.
Yeah.
But you know, I know the animation has a whole story all to itself.
And now, so, you know, just to touch up on some of the things that you brought up, Seton Miller, this was like an unpublished short story for him.
Yeah.
And I also saw that he wrote The Adventures of Robin Hood, the Errol Flynn. He did like a lot of Errol Flynn, like films, like what's the word I'm looking for?
The adventure type, like the real hero type films in the 30s and 40s. Like, I mean, you see a lot, and he just did tons year after year. I mean, there's multiple credits to his name every single year, starting with Paramount, Warner Brothers. I mean, he just goes back and forth through everybody, 20th Century Fox, Universal, just churning out content.
Yeah, so, you know, the background of the story is, you know, one hell of an author. And then, actually, we're going to talk about Malcolm Morenstein. Is that how you said it?
That's how I said it, but I could be wrong on that name.
Yeah, I think that might be right. We're going to bump into him later if we choose to, because he also writes Return to Witch Mountain.
That's a definite if we choose.
Yeah, that's a definite if we choose. We're not promising that by any means. I would.
He also was on Dark Shadows, writer on Dark
Shadows. He wrote like 79 episodes of Dark Shadows.
Not the Johnny Depp one. Though I didn't think it was terrible, that one.
Is that how we're rating those now?
Yeah, not terrible.
All right. That was a review I saw. I guess a trailer for a Bumblebee movie came out.
Yep.
And someone's response was, "It's not awful." And I was like, "Well, all right." Nowhere.
I beg to differ with that review as well.
It's a harsh review. Not harsh enough, though, sir. Going back to the production of the film. So we have our story in place. We need a director. And we get Don Chaffee. Great name. He directed a slew of films and TV, including the episodes of The Prisoner, The Avengers, not that one, the old TV show. A few episodes of Wonderful World of Color, which included, well, which is kind of ironic, actually, because someone listened to that song from the beginning of that show and then said, "What if they were on the water?" We'll get to that later. Including Born to Run, The Three Lives of Tomasina, A Horse Without a Head, which I want to watch. But probably his best-known film is 1963's Jason and the Argonauts, which was, you know, a showcase. God, I think that was the word I'm looking for. For Ray Harryhausen in particular. But Tom Hanks, at an awards show that was honoring Don Chaffee, he actually called, for him, his personal thing, that Jason and the Argonauts is the best film ever made. High praise. Cinematography was by Frank V. Phillips, who also shot our upcoming flick, The Black Hole. And he also did Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Return to Witch Mountain. So there's some pedigree in there,
Return,
I guess.
Return from Witch Mountain.
There's Return to or from?
From.
Gotcha. Escape to Witch Mountain. Return to Witch Mountain. What? I know. I'm just joking around. He also shot Midnight Madness, though, which matters the most, quite frankly. Let's be honest. All these people, though, they need actors. If you got people with a camera, you got people all doing all this stuff, you need actors. Melissa, who the hell's in this movie?
A lot of people.
Oh, we don't need to go through that whole thing. There's four that we got to talk about.
I got a little bit more than four. But not all of them have a very long list, so that's good. We'll go with our first one, Pete. He's played by Sean Marshall. He was mostly a young child star, did a couple of TV shows, the Fitzpatricks, The Mackenzies of Paradise Cove. He did a Disney short film, The Small One. And then a year after this movie came out, he left acting.
Because he became a full-size adult.
Because he was like,
that was it.
I can't do this no more.
He grew 86 feet.
The dragon traumatized him. I don't know. But then that ended his acting, so. We have our, I guess, semi-fellow co-star in Nora, who is played by Helen Reddy. She was from Australia. She's basically, she is an established singer, and she was known as the queen of 70s pop. Amazing.
Where?
In Australia, I'm assuming.
Okay, so I read that there was someone else of Aussie nobility that was up for this role, but the timing didn't work out. And I got two people shaking their heads. You guys want to say the name at the same time? Okay, on three, as in one, two, three, then you say it. Courtney and Ryan are going to tell you who it was. One, two, three.
Olivia Newton-John.
Newton-John.
Yes. Skype worked out so brilliantly in that sequence. That's just the dumbest idea every time I do that, but that's why I like it. Yes. Yeah, so, but really, she was known as the queen of
70s pop.
Yeah.
Her song is I Am Woman.
Oh, really?
Yes. She's a feminist icon, yeah.
Okay. I will say she has a, not a Hollywood-type beauty to her, but she's very beautiful, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she fits that.
Was that really her on the barrels? That's really all I want to know.
The dancing?
I mean, the shots made it look like it.
The shots really made it look like it.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a dancer, so maybe.
I don't know. It's a long scene. Like 18 minutes of barrel rolling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
I want to go back to Sean Marshall for a second, because you said something I didn't realize until just this moment.
He was a child.
Has anybody else seen The Small One? Does anyone else even know what that is?
No, what is that?
I'm sorry, it's been on every Christmas DVD I've ever received from Disney. So, like, it's it's the story of a little boy who had to take a donkey to the market, right, and he's been told to sell him basically to the people who are going to use the hide and kill this donkey. And it's like, but it's my pet, the small one. Small one is my pet. And he ends up selling it to Joseph to carry Mary to give birth to Jesus. Like, it's that's the short.
Oh.
And it's, and it has a song. And
of course it does.
Yeah, it does. And so go check that out. But I didn't realize he's the voice of the boy who did that.
So there you go. Now all you right. know.
There you go.
More songs.
Disney basically put a Shyamalanian twist in a short, an animated short. It's like, but wait, Jesus. Like, ah!
Helen Reddy, so she was mainly, you know, she did a TV appearances. She did some stage work on Broadway and the West End, but not so much more in movies. Stuck to the small stage, I guess, is
all right.
That way to go. We have her father, Lampy, who's played by none other than Mickey Rooney.
The underperforming.
Yes.
He's very, very,
very subdued.
Yeah, it's just calm.
Subtle.
Nothing, subtle. Stillness. He's a big guy about stillness.
I did read a quote. He is one of the most enduring performers in show business. He's appeared in over 300 films. He was one of the last surviving stars of the silent film era, which probably goes towards his understated performances.
As soon as that sound came in, he was like, I'm going. They'll never silence me again.
And he had one of the longest careers in movie history. He worked up until his death in 2014 and had two films released posthumously. We'll hear him again in The Fox and the Hound. And if we so choose, in Lady and the Tramp 2, Scamp's Adventure.
We so not choose. I can tell you that right now.
Hard pass.
Yeah, no, well, that's a hard pass.
Oh, but
yeah.
Scamp is cute. And of course, I just picked a couple of movies. It's a Madman, Mad Ord World, Breakfast at Tiffany's, one. Babyface Nelson.
Jesus Christ, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Guys, don't look up his performance at Breakfast at Tiffany's. There's some things that haven't aged well. That is right up there.
He was also in Night at the Museum and 2011's The Muppets, so... Got some current stuff.
He was in there for like legitimately 3 seconds.
He was in there. That's all that
he
matters.
He turned his cap. He sang a line at the camera.
He sang. That's all that matters.
Of all the movies, you picked a 3 second cameo.
Because it's the Muppets.
All right. You know, I get it. He is in there though. Yeah. It's during the opening song. What's that? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's it. That's the opening music we're going to use from now on.
Okay.
Is Life's a Happy Song?
Yes. There you go. Life's a Happy Song.
Then we go to our villain. We have Dr. Terminus. Very good name.
All-star of the film.
Played by Jim Dale. He's best known for his British movies, Carry On film series. There was 11 of them. I also found this interesting. He recorded all 7 Harry Potter audiobooks, and he was narrator for the Harry Potter video games.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know him, you might know his voice. And he also did another Walt Disney film, Hot Lead and Cold Feet.
What year was that? Do you remember?
No, I don't.
That sounds like an 83 movie.
Got to be somewhere in this title.
Right? Yeah, somewhere.
Can someone look that up so I can smash my head against this table?
It's got a very 80s.
Every time we mention a movie, I'm like, God, I hope it's after the year that we're reviewing.
It's 78.
So technically it is.
Sorry, guys. We missed it.
No, he didn't.
What year is this? 77?
Yeah.
77.
All right. No. Mm-hmm.
It's a Western, by the way. It's a comedy Western.
If we did all the studio films, like all of them.
Oh, we'd be still back.
Well, you know what? It would be, the people who are listening, you would have to let us know that you don't want us to do the other, in my opinion, basic stuff that we sometimes cover sometimes. I'll go deep diving into this horrid bath of filth. We would go back in time first, though. We'd have to catch up on all the things we already missed.
Yeah.
It's a comedy Western with Don Knotts.
Of course. Well, sure. Of course it is.
Yeah, you can't have that.
Jesus. What wasn't Don Knotts in? Peach Dragon, evidently. That's about it.
Before we do that, we would have to go back and do Apple
Dumpling Gang, right? Yeah.
to go along with our Dr. Terminus.
The island above. What the hell is that
called?
Oh,
the island on the top of the world.
Island on top of the world?
The movie we don't speak of. I can't watch it a third time.
You know, due to like complicated schedules, this film was on the verge
of going there,
of going in that direction, just because it had been so far from when we watched it. I'm sorry, Melissa, keep going.
It's okay. We can't have a villain without a sidekick, so we have Hoagie, which is Dr. Tremors' sidekick, played by Red Buttons, the best of names. He had his own TV show, The Double Life of Henry Fife, because of course he did. He was in a slew of other movies. He was in Sayonara with Marlon Brando, Hatari with John Wayne, 5 Weeks in a Balloon, The Poseidon Adventure, When Time Ran Out with Paul Newman. And he was in a 2-part TV movie, which is the one I think that I watched, which I really want to dig up. It was Alice in Wonderland. It was 1985.
Oh.
He played the White Rabbit, but the cast is like amazing.
Okay.
Donald O'Connor, Shelley Winter, Sammy Davis Jr., Scott Baio, Sid Caesar, Ringo Starr.
Like, was anyone under 60 years old besides Scott Baio?
I don't know, but I need to find that movie.
Over 6 feet of dirt.
Because I think that's the Alice in Wonderland that I always remember. It's scary.
In my brain, I can picture the cover art. I don't know why. Like a checkered background.
All I remember is it was at the end where, like, I think it was the Jabberwocky came through the mirror. That's all I remember.
Jabberwock. Is it Wocky or Jabberwock?
The poem is the Jabberwock.
But in the book, in some things, they say Jabberwocky, don't they?
In the text, they say Jabberwocky.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
Jabberwocka, wocka.
No. And just a couple other quick ones. We can't skip Shelley Winters, who is our Lena Gugan.
Mm-hmm.
She's the matriarch.
Say the best movie she was ever in.
The Poseidon Adventures?
Not the Adventures. That was a one-way ticket. Night of the Hunter.
Yes, I had that down. Oh, good. She was also in Winchester 73, The Great Gatsby in 1949. She was in The Portrait of a Lady in 1996 with Nicole Kidman and John Malkovich.
Can I give a really good literature joke that I read this week?
Sure.
Ryan Reynolds should play the lead in Gatsby because he's been Green Lantern and Deadpool.
Very nice.
It's
I don't know.
Good.
He was in the timeline. I don't think he was Green Lantern anymore.
Oh,
I think that we fixed the timeline.
What a deep cut, though. That I read that, I was like, my brain was like, wait, oh.
I get it.
Wow. Okay.
And just going back to our Passamaquoddy town, we have the mayor, Jim Backus. He was well known for his voice of Mr. Magoo. And he was also in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
And? Boat cruise? Doomed?
Nope.
Gilligan's Isle.
Oh, okay. I wasn't going TV. I was doing movies. He was the mayor in M also. So he likes to play mayors.
Wait a minute.
What?
Not like...
Yes.
The old German film?
M. Yes.
That can't be right.
I looked it up.
No, I mean, like, I'm sure you're right. I'm thinking of a different movie.
I thought it was the one we watched.
Yeah?
Pretty sure.
Movie's from 1931. What was he, playing the mayor at, like, the age of 10?
Maybe. Maybe he was a child mayor.
He would have been in trouble in that movie then.
It's Parks and Rec suddenly. I don't know.
Ice Town.
I mean, wait, what's his name? What was his name again?
Jim Backus.
There's no way Jim Backus was in an all-German 1931 movie. Or maybe he was.
I don't know.
It says
well,
him,
who
though.
Else is in this movie?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I got to look this up now. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. And we have our other voice, voice of Elliot, Charlie Callis. He was the soothsayer in History of the World Part 1. And
a long trip.
he was well known. He opened for Frank Sinatra all over the country, and he had over 50 appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So there you go.
All right. We have a cast. We have a crew. We have cameras. Ugh. My God, is there any music in this movie? Who would know? I think Courtney will know.
There's at least 1,000 of musics in this movie. this is quite a movie when it comes to the music. We do have someone who wrote a score for this film. This was written by Irwin Kostel, even though I don't remember a time too much in this movie where people weren't just straight up singing songs. So I would like to hear the score and not the songs at some point in my life. I don't know that I've done that.
That's a good point.
Yeah. People are singing pretty much the whole time.
It's kind of silent unless they're singing a song.
Yeah, there's transitions. So that was obviously written by Irwin Kostel, but I would like to hear a score. But Irwin Kostel, he arranged and conducted Bedknobs and Broomsticks and Mary Poppins, and he received Oscar nominations for Pete's Dragon, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and Mary Poppins. And Irwin Kostel was self-taught. He didn't go to college. He studied scores in a library, and that's how he learned to compose. So he has a pretty interesting story. But he's most well known for arranging Broadway musicals. He won the Academy Award for Best Original Music Score for The Sound of Music, as well as Best Original Musical for West Side Story. And he was inducted as a Disney Legend in 2004. But most importantly, I think, to this film are the songwriters, Al Kasha and Joel Hirshhorn. They were originally hired just to write Candle on the Water, but the studio liked it so much that they decided to make this movie into a musical. And then it exploded.
and then they combusted.
Yeah, and they wrote 6,000 songs. So they had been working together writing pop songs long before this film, and they had also won Oscars together for The Morning After from The Poseidon Adventure, which starred Shelley Winters and Red Buttons.
Jesus, why is that movie coming up so much today?
Everybody's in it, I guess.
A sinking boat.
Yeah, and their second Oscar was for We May Never Love Like This Again from The Towering Inferno. They were also nominated for...
Theme.
Yeah. they were also nominated for Candle on the Water, but that lost to You Light Up My Life that year. And then they were also nominated for a couple Tony Awards for Copperfield and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. So that's kind of what we got going on with our music in this film.
All right. Whole lot of music. There is some more just background stuff I want to talk about. Ken Anderson. Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong. This is the last work that he does with Disney in designing Elliot?
It is. He designs Elliot. It's the last movie for a couple of people. Don Bluth, this is his real last movie.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a second.
I believe it's the first movie that had animation in it that had none of the nine old men working on it.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So there's a lot of first and last in this movie.
Yeah, and in particular, you know, animation director Don Bluth, as you said before, along with Gary Goldman and John Pomeroy, they applied for overtime during this because they were regularly working over 100-hour weeks and basically were told, like, no, but we'll give you an hour off for each hour worked. They wound up building up 6 weeks of vacation. And in that time, they worked on a private project, which was called Banjo the Woodpile Cat. Don Chafee actually asked that Bluth would get co-directing credit on the film, but Disney said no because there wasn't enough animation in it. One would argue that there's not enough animation in it.
Well, you have the other side of that where they had asked him to create 180 feet, basically, of animation. Like, that's how much animation they wanted. They gave him his budget. They gave him his timeline. They were so impressed. That's when they upped it to, I want to say, with 1,800 feet of animation. But they didn't change his timeline. They didn't change his budget. And he got in trouble for going over budget on that.
Brilliant. There was another Don, though, helping out Don Bluth, and that was Don Hahn, who would go on to later produce Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And something tells me he paid a lot of attention to what wasn't given enough attention maybe here and there on Peach Dragon and did it better down the line on his own. There is another man, though, in the animation team. He's just kind of in there in the animation department. Ron Clement is in here right now. And he would go on to direct The Great Mouse Detective, Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Hercules, Princess and the Frog, and Moana. As Courtney said before, it was actually, this movie was nominated for Best Original Song and Best Score, but it was also nominated for 4 Saturn Awards, because this is something I saw. So it was nominated for Best Fantasy Film, Supporting Actor, Costume, and Special Effects. But this is the real...
Wait, you forgot to say which actor it was.
What was it? Which was the actor?
Red Buttons.
Red Buttons, you're right.
Can't forget who.
But who did it lose to Best Fantasy Film, you might be wondering?
Yes.
Do you want to know?
Yes.
I will bet I have a guess given the year.
You would be wrong, sir.
Would I really?
That would have been in the sci-fi category.
Oh, okay, yeah, you're
the
right.
The fantasy category was ruled with a limp fist by George Burns's Oh God. Yep.
Of course.
Yeah. Another film that was nominated actually in that same category, Slipper and the Rose, which was written by the Sherman Brothers. This would be the first movie that was also released on the VHS. On the VHS.
I had many of those.
Many of them clamshells, eh?
I never had this one, though. Of all the Disney ones. Sorry, go ahead, Courtney.
Sorry, I'm talking over you today. I believe this was the first one recorded in Dolby Stereo, too.
Well, that's so much damn singing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to hear the 25,000 songs.
I mean, all right, so we got to talk about this movie. So that's the movie.
That's what we're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. We haven't really talked about this movie. Yeah. Like, we got to really, it's like, you know, if there's like a murder and you just call your, like, hey, you hear about that murder? Like, that's when you're talking about it. But then when you get to the scene, like, that's when you're really talking about it. This is that situation right now. So we're going to the scene. And Harrison Ford is wagging his finger at me, telling me, I didn't kill my wife. So at least I hope he is. Wasn't enough finger wagging in Solo. That would be my only complaint.
He didn't get there yet. He had to be an old crotchety man.
Yet. Yeah, he's got to... That man's been wagging his finger at people since Witness.
Got to put some parsecs under the belt before he can get there.
Distance. All right. Movie time, guys. This movie is long, or depending on the cut that you watch, I guess it's long. That's why I actually didn't include the runtime, because it sort of varied between the release, the VHS release, the DVD release, the later Blu-ray release. It was actually labeled incorrectly on one of the Blu-ray releases, where it said it was the cut version, and it wasn't. It was actually the full version. And if you look on the reviews right now for the Blu-ray, they include the reviews for the old version that cut out all the songs, including, I mean, look, if you're going to cut out some songs, I'm kind of behind you. But don't cut out the song that got nominated for a goddamn Oscar. I mean, Jesus, don't you maybe leave that one in? So I left out the runtime because it's just it's a mess. But we watched the long version, so... I'm gonna pivot right over to just Ryan and Courtney.
Oh no!
Oh yeah! I like the opening of this movie. We've got the oil painting credits, which I thought was a really nice touch, change of pace.
Mm-hmm.
But Courtney, cannibals. Tell me about them.
The cannibals.
Oh my God! Tell me about one of them in particular too. Now that I think of it.
Oh yes.
That was one of the insane cast things.
I got you, Melissa.
Melissa, you know what? No, let Melissa say it.
Okay, go.
Melissa, yes. There's cannibals.
There are.
There's a song. There's a very Broadway-ass song, too. Courtney first said it, and then Melissa, you wrote it on the phone.
I did.
What's going on?
It's Kinnicky.
It's Kinnicky. that's a new show that we're putting out next week called It's Kinnicky.
It's Kinnicky.
Where we just follow the whatever the hell he did. But yeah, what's his name? I forget his name.
I'm looking
at Conway.
Jeff Conway is one of the four Witch Mountain. This Witch Mountain. The music starts off and we're writing a song about poor people wanting to eat a poor kid. I don't know. But Courtney, you enjoy this opening ditty?
I do enjoy this opening ditty. I mean, it's as, about as Broadway as you can get.
It really is, right?
Yeah, yeah. And there's great choreography in it. The set is, it's a practical set, which is
true.
Good. That's it, that's a nice thing to see when you look at these old movies and you see a good practical set. And I mean, the cast is perfect for what the purpose that they're serving in this scene.
Yeah.
I'll go along with that.
A lot of physical humor.
Jeff Conaway, all over the place.
Absolutely.
Falling backwards and then rolling like this. It's an audio podcast. That didn't really work that well for the go home. Just shake your hands around in the air, guys. There you go. That was pretty much it. Ryan, what'd you think of Peach Dragon? You know, we're not going to do scene by scene. My God. Remember we used to do that madness? Insane thing to do with movies that are more than 5 minutes
long. And
then
we got to Mary Poppins and we were here for 2 days and yeah.
So what do you think of Peach Dragon though?
It's not the movie I remember as a child, but there's still enough of it. Like there's still enough humor in it. There's still songs that I absolutely adore. You could take them out of the movie. I don't care. Like I still think that there's some great songs. You know, I think there's a heavy dose of nostalgia for me. But like I said, there's still enough fun moments in it that when I watch it, it's still enjoyable.
I like the Terminus character a lot.
Dr. Terminus.
But when we meet the doctor, we lose Pete and his dragon for like a solid 30 minutes.
Yeah, there's a lot of like editing that can be done to make it like go like quickly, because if you like just have like a brief plot, like it sounds really good, but then like when they drag it all out, that's when it starts to have.
So it felt draggy to you?
Issues.
Did it feel draggy to you?
Draggy?
No, I think you said it drag on. It drag on.
No, I actually wasn't even trying to do a pun. I was asking.
I don't believe you.
No, I swear. Like I've ever not admitted to a pun with all of a sudden we're acting like that. But did you find that the movie, I guess I'll have to put it a different way, did not go at a decent pace for you?
It did not. There was a lot of like stuff that happened where it was just like, okay, like move on, get going. Do things, because I feel like the villain shows up like a third through the movie and like or more, and you're like, oh, all of a sudden here we go, now we have like more conflict. I don't know,
was almost no conflict until he was like, I can eat this dragon or whatever. That was interesting. Like he knows he's a huckster, but he's like, if I get a dragon, I can really heal people. It's like, yeah, but you don't really heal people, so do you really need a dragon? Stupid things I think of when I was watching this movie.
He was
movie.
On a quest. He had to get the dragon scale and the dragon.
He was on the run. He was good. He was really good.
I do wonder if some of that is the byproduct of adding in more songs than they originally intended, adding in more of Elliot animation than they originally intended. Like, I wonder how much of that they're like, okay, well, if we have to do that, then we have to do this lead-in scene, or we have to do this outro scene, or like, how much of that added to the padding in here?
Yeah, I wish I knew. Do we know, Courtney, by any chance, do we know what the songs that were added were? Oh, they were all added outside of Candle, right?
Except yeah.
So all 11 outside.
I could do without the I Love You Too song.
I don't even remember that one.
That was the one in the very beginning with, but, you know, I love you too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that he sang.
But the apple orchard, yeah.
But you don't get Elliot doing his boom, 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 boom.
Okay, all right. You know you got a point there. That's true. That was pretty good, Gord.
That was
great. I mean, I've seen it a lot of times.
That was really good. That's all right. I've seen a lot of movies a lot of times. I can't mimic them very well. Yeah, so I do think there's a little bit of an issue with the pacing in the film. I will say, though, I think the film's shot really well. There's a lot of, as Courtney said, there's a lot of practical effects going on here, and they all look pretty fine, you know, given the thing. I really liked the effect that they did towards the end of the film when Elliot's supposed to be under the tarp, and they must have just built, you know, like the working animatronic skeleton to an extent of this dragon, and I think it looks really good even now. The barrel rolling scene is fun. That's really like, that's one sequence where I was like, this is going on way too long.
Yeah.
Like if I could cut a song immediately, like this is not necessary. the what would you call it? It was a dragon or something like that. A dragon.
I saw a dragon.
Yeah, that whole thing. I could have done without that.
What about Brazzle Dazzle Day?
Was that in the town? That was in the town center, right?
That's the one where they're at the lighthouse and they're cleaning the windows.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, we don't need that either. Candle in the Water is really good, though. Courtney, you cry?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, it's one of my favorite things. It's, I'm not a great piano player, but it's one of the few things I've learned to play on the piano just so I can sing it. Like, it just makes me really happy. I love it.
Oh, yeah. You never...
played the piano?
No. Yeah. Well, no, beyond that. Explained what we noticed with that song.
Oh, Candle on the Water. Yeah. Courtney, give me a few bars of Candle on the Water. 3, 2, 1.
I'll be your candle on the water.
Now sing me the theme song to It's a Wonderful World of Color.
I don't know if I know that.
The world is a carousel of color.
Yeah,
it's
you're right.
The same damn thing. But in its defense, someone else, in my opinion, stole the melody from this movie when it's...
I have the song list.
It's a Jim Dale song. It's the Passamaquoddy. It's Passamaquoddy
song. Yeah.
That song has the same exact rhythm to it as We Can Do It from the Producers.
Mm-hmm.
But the more drastic one is, yeah, we were watching the scene and I'm like, I know this song, but I've never heard this song. Well, I have heard it because we did it for a bracket once. But yeah, I mean, it's the same exact melody to Wonderful World of Color. It's kind of a weird thing because, you know, it's a Disney movie. It's like,
yeah.
It's like if, I don't know. If
well, it was supposed to be part of the anthology at some point, so they just brought it over with that.
Yeah. It'd be like if that giant movie ever came out and the first song was like, you know, when you climb a vine of green, be like, Jesus, I know this song. What the hell are you people doing? Oh, other little note, the It's Not Easy song. God, there's so many songs. That was actually covered by Real Big Fish. Mm-hmm. I shared that in the group yesterday. It's a pretty good version of that one. It's Not Easy is a good song. That's a good one. With Reddy and the Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Don't need to see that kid getting changed. It's an awkward scene, but it's fine. It's fine.
They do have a shot right on him while he's changing his shirt. Like, I'm like, what is happening?
Yeah, like she turns her back. Like, I don't want to watch him change. And the camera's like, but what if we do? And I'm like, what if we don't? Like, I don't. What was this?
That's what the audience is here
for. If it's a family film and there's someone in the movie who's like, I shouldn't look. It's improper. Shouldn't have me looking.
They're all friends. It's okay.
Oh, can we talk about that for a split second? Can we just take a really quick dive into Carousel of Progress when the daughter is changing? And she's like, Father, I'm not decent. He's like, it's okay. They're friends. Like, wait a minute. Is that the rule of the house? Like, people just come over for a cup of coffee and they can watch your daughter change clothes? The hell is going on in there?
She also had like 20 layers on.
Yeah, no, that was the funniest thing. She was wearing more clothes than he was.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some pacing problems. The music, I feel, is a little too long in the tooth in a number of scenes. I would like to see the shorter version of this movie, but I wouldn't want to lose Candle in the Water, which I think is inherent in the shorter version. I almost wish I could just edit it myself.
I think you want a peak cut? Yeah.
Yeah, I want like a peak cut. And cut Pete out of the movie. No, I'm just kidding. but that would be my biggest thing was I thought that it just took too long to get things going. About an hour and 10 minutes into the movie, there's still no real conflict. We've learned all the pieces. We know that Reddy's... Oh, God, what's her name?
Nora.
Nora, who only says chowder in a Boston accent. Everything else is, like, straight American. And then, like, chowder. The car was covered in chowder. It's very weird. Very weird. We learned about her... Long lost husband? Did we ever get established to how long he was lost at sea?
A year.
Mm-hmm.
He got amnesia. He was in a hospital and Pete went and basically jarred his memory. Or not Elliot. Pete, Elliot. Elliot went and jarred his memory.
That's why Pete took him down, like took his picture down to the cave to show him. And then Elliot took off and went and like woke him up from his amnesia nap.
Did I die at some time during this movie and miss all?
You might
wait
have.
A minute. Wait. He comes back with the Gordon's fishermen.
Yes.
And they're on land. Wait a minute. He lost his memory?
Yeah, his ship went down. He was like the sole survivor, but he had amnesia, so he was in a hospital.
But not on the island.
No.
No.
But we learned that a dragon talked to him?
Yeah.
I missed that part totally.
Right towards the end where he describes like how he woke up and he realized who he was.
I think I was picking my stuff up at that point. Like I was in the theater putting my coat on like we should beat traffic. Like, oh, but there's a finale. I'm like, no, it's fine. I'll read about it on the internet. I don't know if I completely forgot all about that. I did not remember that. Courtney, what is it about this movie that sticks with you so well? Because you watched it now. You said you hadn't watched it in a long time. So, I mean, I've watched movies that I really liked as a kid. And I'm like, my God, this movie has a lot of, this is not good anymore. But you watched this and you still really dug it. So what is it about the film that you think has like this endearing quality that's kept on for this long?
I really do think it's in the songs. And I know there's too many. I know some of them aren't great. But, I mean, I remember all the words to several of these songs. And I haven't watched this movie in probably 15 years before we watched it a few weeks ago.
Wow.
And I have heard some of the songs. Mostly I've heard Candle on the Water. I listen to that frequently. But I do think the songs are really lasting. I also think, for me, this movie is, like, theatrical, like, made for the stage. The fact that this hasn't been made into a musical is absolutely bananas. I don't understand why it hasn't been, because there are some story issues for sure, and there's some length issues, but the length lends itself to a Broadway show. So I don't know. I really can't imagine why it hasn't been made.
The logistic of the disappearing dragon, I don't know.
But I mean, if they can do the tricks that they do in Phantom or Lion King, yeah. If they can do those tricks, they can do it. They could definitely make this into a stage show, and it would be a super, super cool stage show. So I just think it's something that has high nostalgia value for me. And because of the theatrical, you know, aspects of it, it appeals to me. I still super love it. It makes me really happy.
Melissa, I know you obviously didn't like the movie too much overall, but what were some stuff that you did enjoy? Was there anything you did enjoy?
Honestly, nothing really stuck out to me in terms of like, oh, I really like that. I don't have much. Sorry.
You just want to wear like a black cloth and carry a scythe for the next time I ask you for something like that?
It's hard to pinpoint anything. I mean, like, I don't know. The villain was a typical villain. He had some funny lines. The animation was fine.
I think the animation on Elliot is actually really good.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really, especially with the process that they had to put that animation through for it to show up in the movie.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty standout. Although it does look a little sharper in Mary Poppins, but I think it's just a budgetary thing at that point. I'm not really too sure. Because it's, I mean, you got some years ahead of it. And it seems that it was done a little better, but they also tried to do a lot. It was a lot tougher staging, I feel, in this particular situation. I don't know, like that cave sequence seems like a real pain in the ass to get correct with, you know, trying to do the live action stuff. Ryan, how about you? I mean, are there pluses and negatives to Peach Dragon after watching it on this one?
There are. Just hit on kind of two things that we've kind of touched on recently. You know, Sean Marshall, the reason he got the job was because in the test, they put him out in like a field, like to like he was talking to Elliot, and he was the only kid who cried during his screen test. Like it was like the goodbye scene to Elliot. And it's because he was staring up into the sun because he was thinking about where the dragon would be. And that's the reason he beat out all the other kids who were actual actors at that point.
Great.
I think it does lend itself towards a stage production, and Disney has a history of this. You know, the Newsies is not a good movie. Newsies is not a good movie. The Broadway play is excellent. You know, they do have a way to, you know, to take something that maybe wasn't great in their catalog and make it better in its proper environment. That said, you know, it there's a lot of Elliot that I love in this movie. You know, all the animation, all of his scenes, he's just, you know, whether it's the heart or the humor, I really, really like how he is portrayed. I do think Jim Dale and Red Buttons, his sidekick, Hoagie,
yeah,
I think they're a standout. I think maybe we have, you know, one villain too much with the family.
Yeah.
I think we could have just, you know, we could have had the backstory of he ran away. Great. I don't need the rest of that coming back up to bite us.
But in this, you know, if you were to do a stage version, would you keep them?
No, I don't think I would. I think Courtney would. I don't think I
believe Courtney would with gusto. You know what?
I think it's one or the other, or you combine them into one thing. You know, if we're talking about a swamp, you know, family lives in the swamp, maybe they, you know, they also dabble in, you know, shysterness with their, you know, selling of medicine and, you know, all that stuff. Make it, simplify it somewhere. You know, there's a lot of making Pete out to be the bad kid in town because of the antics of Elliot.
They hit that button a little too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where I started thinking like Elliot's a real dick. Like that was one of the reactions that I had during the movie. And I was like, wait, that's not what I'm supposed to be feeling.
See, I never felt that way. I felt like Pete was being annoying because he was like, Elliot, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Like, he was just like,
don't rip people's clothes off. I mean, that's kind of,
he didn't
look,
rip the,
Melissa obviously is in for ripping elderly women's panties off in town squares.
That's not what happened at all.
That's, yeah.
Sort of what happened.
But no, there's some pacing issues. There are some, you know, there are some issues here, but it's at the heart of it, it's still, you know, I said earlier, it's still something that I enjoy. Like, I'll still, you know, it's been a while since I've watched it. I'll go back and watch it again somewhere down the line because it has a fondness that I can't really go too far away from.
Melissa, I want to go back to what you were saying. You think that Pete was really the issue with the Elliot Pete thing?
Yeah, I didn't really care for how he was treating Elliot, like especially like that first sequence of them going into Passamaquoddy, and where, you know, I understand like he's telling Elliot like, you know, you got to be sneaky and blend in or whatever, and obviously Elliot's a huge dragon, he can't. But like, I don't know, I just felt like Pete kept berating him, and it was like, I don't know. Pete was like more like a jerk. I didn't really care for him.
All right. Well, many people don't care for Pete. I know that for a fact.
It's true.
But Courtney, where do you lie on this thing with you know, with the constant reprimanding and or the constant "I'm going to make your life worse" from Imaginary Dragon?
I think mean, he's imaginary for most of the movie to most people.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
That's fine. I think that the way that Pete reacts to Elliot is a result of how Pete is treated by other people because Elliot can't be seen. That might be a little bit too high level thinking for this movie. That's the way that I think about it, because, I mean, Pete's the one that's getting all the crap from people because Elliot has to stay invisible or it'll be a huge issue. So I think Pete's kind of being crappy to Elliot because he's getting crapped on all the time.
What did you guys think of the incomparable, subtle performance of Lampy?
I think he needed to amp it up a little bit.
No, not. I mean, in all seriousness, do you think it's a little too much sometimes? Or does it fit the film? Like, does it need that kind of boost? Because a lot of the movie is actually kind of subdued in many, many scenes.
It is. I just feel like they didn't do much with his character. Like, for all the you know, big theatrical I Saw a Dragon thing, like, it didn't really amount to much.
When you say I Saw a Dragon, would you like to take a 10-minute intermission and go dancing on some barrels for a little bit before you come back?
No. Leg day was the other day and my legs are sore.
Very well. Yeah, he seems to have some, like... Well, first he says some awful things to Norma. Nora. In my head, something else happened. When he's like, you know, your husband's dead, like in so many words. I was like, Jesus, that's pretty rough. But yeah, he doesn't really seem to have much of a vehicle in this movie other than to be the first one to see Elliot. And then, I don't know.
Yeah, like, and that could have been
his drunkenness is what gets him into trouble, like an hour and 25 minutes into the movie, when him and Hoagie go and, you know, basically find El Dragon. But yeah, he definitely seems to not really have much of a spot too much. Or maybe I overlooked it. Ryan, what'd you think?
No, I think that character shines when he's with like Hoagie, like the two of them playing off of each other.
Yeah.
And I think that even the history of that, I think they had to keep reshooting that because the first time when they were both trying to outdo each other with how drunken they appeared, and it went on and on and on, and they were like, yeah, we need 30 seconds. You guys just did 10 minutes, and they kept, you know, in that one-upmanship. I think some of that's fine. I think it was really good in the movie how they played off each other. Put that in different scenes, give them different ways to do that. It expands both the characters a little bit, but yeah, otherwise he's just kind of, you know, this very timid, worried about the dragon, wants to make sure that Pete's not going to bring the dragon in the, you know, in the lighthouse. Yeah, it does get a little repetitive.
So we have a lot going for it. I think we have some also, we have some going against it as well in this film. But did you guys want to note anything else that particularly happened in the film, or did you want to get towards the questions? I'm going to leave this open for three. Oh, Ryan?
I would say, no, I think I'm good. And I think I'm good. We can move to questions.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so too.
So, Melissa, mm-hmm. We asked three questions.
We do.
Of every film.
We haven't asked them in a long time.
We haven't done one of these in a long time. What are these three questions? Because I don't remember them.
Well, we were going to ask if it still holds up.
Yes, that I remember.
We're going to ask what the iconic shot is.
I definitely remember that one.
And we're going to ask if it has a moral or an emotional pull to the film, and if it succeeds in doing either or neither.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's start with the emotional. You know, is this film trying to give a moral? Is it trying to hit your emotional buttons? Does it succeed on either level? I'm going to go with Ryan first.
The moral is don't be a cannibal, mm-hmm. or a snake oil salesman. No, I think it's emotional. I think it's really more of an emotional story. You know, it's an orphan. He's his only friend in the world. He's trying to find a family that loves him. He eventually does. You know, you can make the argument for like the don't judge a book by its cover kind of a thing, but I think that's a stretch. I think it's just emotional. I think it succeeds at moments. I think overall, maybe it's not as strong a case as they wanted it to be. It wasn't as strong a case as they wanted it to be, but there are still moments of that are going to pull at your heartstrings.
See, I think it is trying to do a moral, and I think that you said it. I do think that it's trying to do the whole, you know, accept people for what they are, the book cover and all that kind of stuff. Because they show it with Elliot, and they also show it in the treatment of Pete from the school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where like it doesn't matter if this kid actually does anything positive. She already thinks that she knows everything about him because he's poor. So I think it is trying to go for that moral. I think that they do get it across. I just don't think it really is very impactful because it gets lost amongst the other, you know, 140 minutes of runtime. I don't think that it really sticks out very much when you try to give that idea. But then there's a 25-minute dance sequence and a 10-minute drunken sequence. And, you know, just like all these gags that go on just a little too long. Just a little too long in every little piece. I don't know if... I think I would have had to watch this younger to get affected by Pete leaving because I've seen that in so many movies. And this one didn't do anything specifically special for it to stand out. You know, like, I could watch E.T. tomorrow and that will make me ruinous. I can watch Before Sunrise and that will ruin me. This one didn't really have too much of an effect on me though. Melissa, how about you?
I'm probably in the same boat. Yeah, there were some morals, around not only with Pete, but even, you know, judging the good old doctor, not really being what he says he is, but
he's a good man and thorough.
But I think it was really more targeted towards the emotion. I mean, you can't say it's not emotional with the song Candle in the Water in there. So, I mean, it's definitely an emotional film. But yeah, maybe if I had seen it when I was younger, it would be more impactful. But for me, it was just kind of like, okay, good. I'm glad he found a family. And now the dragon will go harass someone else.
See, but that's what I was saying. I don't know. Correct me, you know, tell me what you think. You saw Coco less than a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you started crying.
Yeah, I don't know. It.
I don't think that it has to do with your age. I think it has to do with that effectiveness.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. And for me, this movie just wasn't that effective.
Courtney, how about you? Is there a moral that you've taken away from this movie? Has it worked emotionally for you?
Morally, honestly, since I was a kid, like, the thing I took away from this is you shouldn't own a person.
That's a good moral.
For real,
since I was a kid. You know what? That's a good point. They literally bought that child.
They did. It bothered the crap out of me ever since I was a child. I was like, what the hell? This isn't cool. Like, that was the one moral that I took from it since I was a kid. But other than that, it's 100% emotional for me. I don't think that the ending is, I still cry at the ending, but I think that's a nostalgia thing. I don't think the ending is as effective as the remake that they did. I was absolutely like in pieces in the remake, the ending of the remake.
Really?
I think it was more effective. They had more build up to it.
Okay.
You had more emotional investment. I think in this one, you don't, it's really abrupt. Like, you don't expect that Elliot is going to leave. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, Elliot has to go help other kids. That kind of makes sense. So you don't get the emotional impact of that.
Also, I just don't think that Pete's like relationship with him showed that emotional connection. Like, it wasn't,
Elliot,
like,
needs to find another kid.
It was like, you know, and I haven't seen the remake, but just from the trailers and stuff, I could surmise that, you know, like, this kid, like, this dragon is his only friend. Like, it is his, you know, like, buddy, and like, he cares about it, and he cares if anything happens to it. And like, that just wasn't there in this movie for me. Like, if anything, Pete was really rude to him in a lot of parts, and it didn't seem like he appreciated what Elliot, you know, was trying to do for him. I know Elliot did it in his own clumsy fashion, so it wasn't always perfect, but I don't know. So, like, yeah, when he left, it was just kind of like, all right, you know.
Peace.
You
can see there, though, how they were trying to get that Mary Poppins vibe.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I've got to move on to another family.
They're making a Disney's Avengers out of this, actually. It's going to be Mary Poppins and Pete and the genie and, you know, all of them. They're all going to get
together.
Ghost
of Old Yeller.
No.
What?
No.
You can't forget Merlin.
Yeah.
And Merlin.
The
there
most
you go.
Helpful.
Iconic shots.
I always told there was one.
Pretty sure there's only one. Melissa.
The lighthouse. No. It's got to be when, in the beginning, when Pete's singing to Elliot and he's like sitting on his stomach and they're sharing the apple.
I offer up a different suggestion.
Okay.
It's a Candle on the Water shot when she's in front of the light and, you know, she's singing. It's an abrupt cut. I'm going to say that. Like, there's no build into that song. She like walks off set and then right into the song. But actually, I think that's the one shot that I really remember. And I think that's the biggest takeaway is that number. I know it has really nothing to do with the title of this damn movie, but those two characters also weren't in this movie for about an hour of the runtime. So I don't think that's my fault. I'm going to go with the shot of Norma Jean Rae in front of the lighthouse. Norman Bates. Ryan?
Real fast because I realized I didn't mention this earlier.
Be that furious lighthouse, about it too.
That lighthouse was actually going to be moved to Disneyland. They were going to install it over at Disneyland afterwards. But by the time they finished production, it had deteriorated so much that there was no hope of doing that. So there's your Disneyland tidbit for the day. I'm with Melissa. It's Elliot. It's Pete sitting on Elliot's stomach, sharing an apple, like singing. That's the scene I remember, or the shot I remember.
Courtney Van Rens, CVR.
I'm going to go with the same scene, but I'm going to go with a slightly different shot. I like Elliot and Pete cheek to cheek in that scene. Okay. I posted that GIF on Facebook yesterday. So for those of you that are my friends on Facebook, you can see what I'm talking about. Shazam. Specifically when they're cheek to cheek. That's my shot.
Does this film hold up Ryan Wilson? Does it physically hold Ryan Wilson up?
Does it hold me up? It had to be a really strong reel to hold me up. Personally, yes. I can't say it doesn't, because of, you know, that it still tugs on my heartstrings when I watch it. But I also know that someone who's never seen it, somebody sitting down for the first time, even maybe kids sitting down for the first time, don't have that same. It doesn't hold up as well to them. To me, it holds up.
See, I'll argue that because I know
we had no idea.
No. Just the because Steph has shown it to Ava, and Ava is going to be 4 now, and Ava loves it. So for a young kid nowadays, apparently it does hold up.
Oh, for that kid, yeah.
I will say Ava and I are on very similar wavelength. Like Ava and I are on Big Al, Country Bear. There you go. We will belt that song out when we're together. So Ava's maybe not the best case for
this. Yeah,
we'll wait a couple years to see with Frankie.
She is a child.
Well, she's the only child that I have reference to. But I'm just saying, she's a modern age child.
Modern age child.
Who didn't see it in, you know, when it came out on VHS or whatever.
So, Melissa, does this film hold up?
I'll never not go back to watching it.
Is that a no?
For me, it's a no. I won't go watch it again.
It's not something I'm going to seek out. I am looking forward to watching the sequel, though, because I have heard a lot of people say, well, whatever.
Not a sequel.
Tarzan's Dragon, which is what I got from the trailer. I was like, all right, sure. Where's Phil Collins?
You're not totally. More like Jungle Book Dragons.
Jungle Book Dragons. I don't. For me, it just didn't work out too well. I just thought it was 25 minutes too long. I do like Elliot, though. I like the design, the look, the feel of that character. There's just way too much stuffing put around the title characters. We lose touch with them way too much in the middle of the movie for the ending to then have any impact on me at all. But I also did like Terminus. So I think a slimmer version of this movie would actually work very well for me. Courtney.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this one holds up for me. I'll definitely always watch this one. If I have children someday, I'll show it to them. If I'm babysitting children, I'll put it on for them.
If I kidnap children, I'll show them.
If I kidnap them. I think this one holds up. I can see how it would not work so well for people with a shorter attention span or people that just have a discerning eye when it comes to storyline.
What about both? That would be me.
Or both. I can see how that wouldn't work out. And I think I do have more patience for that because I have so much nostalgia and history with the film. So for me, it would hold up, but I can see how it wouldn't for others.
Yeah, I definitely don't. I mean, just personally, I know I don't have an issue with slowness in films, given the category of films that I usually enjoy. But this one just didn't click. But I am looking forward to watching the update with Pocahontas.
I think we need to be clear, though. If Courtney ever kidnaps kids, she's going to, Brigsby Bear the movie. She's going to create it for the child in whole cloth herself.
All right, guys. Well, hey, that's our look back and review at 1977's Peach Dragon. I hope you enjoyed that. And if you know, if you're a fan of the movie, let us know. Let us know on the Facebook page and all that. And what are we doing? Well, next week, I'm not going to be around. I'm going to be watching Bruce Springsteen.
I think we're going to record when you get back.
When I get back, right?
I think that's the calendar, yeah.
All right. We have to talk about that because I might have to travel right after I get back home for work. So we're going to find out what the hell we're doing next week, and I'll let everyone know. And, you know, till then, this episode of Disney Magic Hour has been brought to you by MEI Travel for all your vacation planning needs, for visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, or traveling anywhere around the globe, including Passamaquoddy. Visit the experts over at meitravel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. We are Last Gen Podcast. That's LASTGENpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's DIS Magic Hour Pod. We're on Facebook. Search for Disney Magic Hour. If you're already there, add your friends. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. And if you leave a 5-star review on the iTunes, Melissa here will read the review. How about that? Melissa? Yes. Instagram and Patreon.
Instagram at Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour will find ways to support the show, and you can then be added to our secret Facebook Patreon group where we do live threads of movies.
Illuminati! Ryan, where can everyone find the Main Street Gazette?
MainSTGazette.com. If you're looking for our social media on Twitter and Instagram, we're MainSTGazette. And on Facebook, it's just search for Main Street Gazette and you can find the page.
Courtney, do you want to help me end this show on a high note?
If you're asking me to sing a high note, answer is...
That is exactly what I'm doing.
I will blow this mic.
Take a step back and end this show on a high... All of us end this show on a high note?